That's the longest one. It's the one sentence. Okay, so
this topic that we were asked to discuss for our Sundays is one that is very, very practical, very, very much one of the burning issues of the day, and also certainly goes together with our Masechta. A few years ago, we learned Ksubis here in Yeshiva, and we spent more time on it there. It happens to be, this wouldn't necessarily be your first guess, but this is really most directly a Ksubis sugya. The topic of, really the broader topic is really Kfiya Begidin, really to what extent can we compel someone to divorce. And so therefore, you might guess that this is a Gittin topic, and there are some Gemaras in Gittin that are relevant, but in a lot of ways, it's really a Ksubis topic, and it connects in the many strong ways to Kedushin as well. As you can imagine, it is the opposite end of our Masechta. And towards the beginning of the year, if you recall, we spent some time on the sugya of Das, and illustrate the fact that marriage requires Das from both parties. So a lot of that is relevant to understanding the other half of the equation. So we know that, to kind of talk about where we're at today, so we know that there is an issue that we hear about often, very tragic circumstances, where there are marriages that are effectively over, where there is no real relationship anymore, but they haven't been formally ended. And if they haven't been formally ended, so then halakhically they're not over, and that carries tremendous consequences. It means the parties cannot marry anyone else, and it means that, especially if the woman should marry someone else, then the consequences are very dire. There are the Kili Arayis involved, and there is Rachman al-Islam and Ramzairis involved. There are very serious consequences. Now, we emphasize, we had the opportunity to share a few weeks ago, months ago maybe at this point, to emphasize that we don't want to suggest that adultery is any less of an issue when a man does it than when a woman does it. That from a Ben Adam L'Chaveiro perspective, they are comparable, and the act of a male committing adultery should be viewed with absolute disgust and repulsion. And no one should get the impression that it's any less of a betrayal. But from a Gilui Arayis perspective, which is a different track, and we spent some time discussing this at length, there are additional consequences that are very serious when it's a married woman who is involved. And therefore, if one wants to move on to a new relationship, we need the marriage to be over. Now, to give a little bit of context as well to the modern situation, this is a situation that causes us a lot of anguish, and is something that as a community and a society we are very concerned about, and we should be more concerned about, and it's something that we'll talk about. But just in terms of what it reflects about Jewish law, I think it's important to give it a little bit more perspective. So first of all, it's often assumed that, or it's often portrayed, that in Orthodox Judaism, divorce is totally in the hands of the man. It's up to the man to decide when there will or will not be a divorce. So that's not accurate. Whether there's some truth to it in terms of variance, important details, but practically speaking, that's not accurate. That, at least on a level, midrabanan, meaning the level in which we practice Jewish law today, so divorce is mutual, which means that they both have to agree. So that is the current state of Jewish law, that divorce has to be bilateral. So that may or may not differ from what you find in other cultures and other religions, but practically speaking, that's what it means. Yes, it is true that if it's the wife who refuses, then there may theoretically be other avenues, and I emphasize theoretically, because when the halacha is carried out properly, we are very, very, very hesitant to employ those other options. Yes, it's true that some of the consequences we just mentioned, the serious consequences of Mamzerus and the like, may not necessarily be involved, but given that all the seriousness it deserves, it's still the case that, practically speaking, for a divorce to take place, we require a mutual bilateral
agreement between the parties that the husband has to agree to issue a get and the wife has to agree to accept it. And therefore, this requirement of das that we mentioned in the context of kiddushin. So we find certainly when it comes to the husband that he is obligated to give the get in ritzono, that it has to be something that he is willing to do. And at least on a level midrabanan, it has to be something that the wife is willing to accept, that the husband is not allowed to divorce her bal kocha. And probably more than a midrabanan, I think we also spent some time last semester talking about the question of what does it mean to say there's a cheirus. What does it mean when we say that there's a statement by early rabbinic authorities that something is condemned? So do we mean to say that before that it was permitted? Very possibly not. Maybe sometimes yes, sometimes no. But it's certainly possible to say that very often it was not permitted beforehand. And this is something that Rashi emphasizes this often, that it was never right for a man to divorce his wife, bal kocha. It may work, as opposed to the other way around, but it was never permitted. And Rabbi Gershom just came and emphasized and condemned somebody who would do that. So as a matter of practical halacha, the requirement is that both parties agree to a divorce. So far, so good. Make sense? It's also important just in terms of contrasting halacha with other cultures and with the development of law and the like in the rest of the world. So nowadays, it's very common, I think, in all states in America, in most states, that we're used to the idea of no-fault divorce, meaning that one party can say, I just want out, and therefore there should be a divorce. But that was only a relatively recent development in secular culture. The idea that there doesn't have to be any grounds for divorce is a relatively new development, only in some states, only the past few decades. So again, what everyone feels about the halacha in this area, just to the extent that it differs or not from the rest of the world, should just be aware that for a long time, much of the world, and certainly in America as well, the requirement, the assumption was that a divorce isn't necessarily an automatic right of one party, but that the party has to establish why the divorce is justified, and there has to be an actual ground for divorce. So the question of whether the halacha recognizes anything concept, anything close to no-fault divorce is going to be a sticking point as well. It's maybe something that is also often questioned, and we should just keep it in context and keep it in perspective that this is a relatively new concept as far as the broader world is concerned. Okay? So far, so good? Okay, so again, we'll just try to get some basic principles into the next few minutes, and we'll have to continue this. But the topic of a divorce coming from free will, so the assumption is, as the Rambam writes clearly, that, and you probably saw this, I think I had it early on in the sources, that one of the major requirements of a kosher get is that it comes from the husband's free will. The Torah in Parshas Kiseitse tells us how a get works. It tells us, not in so much detail, but tells us that there's a requirement. It's possibly the same pasuk that is the source for the chi of marriage in the first place. So it's certainly a pasuk that we're familiar with. And so at the beginning of the year, all of the psukim and kiseitse that talk about marriage and divorce and the like. So the Torah tells us that when a man decides he doesn't want to live with his wife anymore, the chasav la sefer krisus v'nasim v'yadav, right? That he has an obligation to write her a sefer krisus and to give it to her. So nowadays, usually the husband doesn't know how to write a sefer krisus. A sefer krisus, what is a sefer krisus? So the Gemara and Gittin will lay out what exactly is what we nowadays call a get. Torah doesn't use the word get, but that's the word Chazal use. It's a little bit of an abbreviation. Tosfos suggests in the beginning of Gittin that it's called a get because the gematria of get is 12, and a get has 12 lines. But a get really just means a get. By the word by get by itself really is just a shtar. Any shtar could be called a get. It's really short for a get krisus. Along those lines, a bill of divorce, as they would say in English. It's the get part of the build part. It doesn't really contain a word that means the worst. But that's necessary sefer krisus. So the kasa of law generally does with shlifus. He generally appoints somebody else to do that. And then the nasa of the other, he's got to give it to her so that he may do himself or he may do that to shlifus as well. Generally, that's done more directly. And there are halachas of how exactly it's given and the like. But the assumption is, it's not clear from the pasuk why this is true. It's not even 100% explicit in the Gemara. You kind of have to get it through the back door. But Allah so we know that it has to be willing. The different Rishonim focus on different words, different ways. And the Gemara, again, is well, kind of aga, but it makes the statement. But we don't claim to be the case that the get has to be given willingly. More than you have a...
not so important, but is it... It says in Aleph and Gimel of Kitzitze that Kasava Sefer Krisos has to be other than Shalom Visa. So which Pasuk is the actual source? I don't know if it's actually...
That's what we're referring to, isn't it?
It's in Aleph and Gimel. I'm thinking it's...
which one are they at? I don't know if it makes a difference. So, in any event, so... this idea that there's an obligation to give it willingly is where we get into a little bit of trouble. Right? So what would happen if the husband is not interested in giving a gift? So the circumstance could then end up being, it would seem, that we're in trouble, because if the marriage is effectively over, but the husband is not going to give a gift, so what will make it over, assuming that indeed it should be over? So that's where we get into a problem. But the Gemara, in a few places, indicates that despite the fact that it has to be willing, it's possible to impose the will upon him. But there is a concept of kfiyah. So we find this in the Mishnayos and the Gemara's of Masechet Ksuvos, where the Gemara says that Kofin, the Mishnah says, the Elu Kofin Lahotzi, that there are some situations where we compel the husband to divorce his wife. The Gemara at the end of Masechet Gittin refers to being Ma'asa Gittin, Ma'asa meaning to compel. The word we're more familiar with nowadays, the other side of the phrase, Get Ma'usa, or the Get Ma'usa, which generally means a problematic get, a get that has been compelled. So the language said means that it was not something you did, but something somebody didified to you, somebody made you do, somebody was ma'asa you, and that's a problem because it's meant to contrast with it being your own decision to do, but somebody, however you want to phrase that in English, somebody made you do it, somebody did it you, so that you were doing it, but not exactly of your own free will. So the Gemara says in Gittin that despite the fact that we normally use the phrase get melusa as a psul to say that this is a problematic get, but the Gemara says that there were those who were ma'asa al get, there were those who were compelling Gittin, and the Gemara only raises the question of whether we have qualified by they didn't do that. But apparently it should have been possible, it should have been something that a bezdin could do, but don't we need smuchim? That nowadays, last year we learned Masechet Sanhedrin, and so do we have qualified dayanim nowadays that you need to have for certain functions of a bezdin, you need to have smuchin, you need to have dayanim who are ordained by Moshe Rabbeinu in a chain going down, and without at all diminishing the fact that we're celebrating Chag HaSmicha here in a few weeks, the fact is that our smicha is not the same as the historical smicha. So what about that? Shouldn't that be a problem? So the Gemara says that shichusayu kavdinam, that on some level it's possible for a contemporary bezdin to compel gittin as well because of a mysterious concept called shichusayu, which sounds like literally means that the contemporary bezdin, despite not having full smicha, can act as emissaries of the once upon a time ordained dayanim. Many explain that it doesn't really mean that it's working through shlichus, it means something else, but that's not necessarily our topic for today. But because of this concept of shlichusayu, it's possible for a contemporary bezdin as well to compel a get. So, question? question becomes, so if that's true, that you can compel a get, and it's also true that a get has to be willing, so how exactly does that work? Now, the Gemara addresses it a little bit, and the Gemara says in Erechin, and then elsewhere, that the whole phrase is, Kofenoso ad sheyovo rotsani. Essentially, make him an offer. You can't refuse in gangster terms, that we compel him until he says, oh yeah, taka, this is what I want to do. So while it does sound like a contradiction in terms, it's certainly not something we encourage in a business context, yet apparently there's some viability to that phrase that we have to figure out exactly why. But if there's some way to sustain that sentence, that you could say at the same time, the person is compelled, and still it's meaningful when he says, wrote something.
Do we have any sense of what that compelling is?
So, yeah, I mean, it sounds like from the Gemara that essentially it was physical pressure. But they would make it clear that it's going to be painful if you wouldn't do it. Now, the truth is, part of why this appears in Ksubas from a couple of contexts. It appears in Ksubas because the Mishnah there says, but there also happens to be a whole other sugya in Ksubas, which may or may not be related. And the Gemara there talks about kofen al mitzvos, that there's such an idea that a bezdin can compel on any mitzvah, even on positive mitzvahs. Let's say somebody doesn't want to take a lulav on sukkos. One of the things the Gemara mentions that a bezdin can exert influence, so to speak, to make sure that people will do it. So the question is this related to that? That's how some understand that it's just a general idea of kofen al hamitzvos, and therefore kviya by gittin is the same idea, or is this some unrelated concept? And then that involves figuring out a few things. What are the requirements for kviya al hamitzvos? Is it more? Is it less? What's the standard for kviya al hamitzvos? Do you need a bezdin? Do you need less than a bezdin? Do you need shilosayhu? Do you need smuchim? So that's a whole discussion as to what exactly is involved in kviya hamitzvos. When do we employ this? So, in the context of trying to figure out how kofen and rotsani work, because even once you say kofen al hamitzvos, it's harder to know that we can transfer that to gittin, because we have this explicit requirement that there has to be rotsani. So this idea that we say rotsani, that has to come with it, that's more unique to gittin than to karbanos. The Gemara says also that karbanos are supposed to be brought willingly, but that there's theoretically a way to compel someone to willingly bring a carpet. So the Gemara has those two concepts in the context of Gittin. So the Rambam has a statement, which is arguably the most famous Rambam in the Mishneh Torah. I'd say possibly the most famous because it's often quoted in the secular press, that when they talk about this Gittin situation, so many will refer to this Rambam, so it has a good shot, good claim at being the most famous Rambam in Mishneh Torah, maybe even more than Yisodus, Rambam HaPasma, or other such things, more than the statement in the Parish of Mishnayos, the Likud and the Flaw, but I have a list of the top 10 Rambams, but this one is definitely up there as far as fame is concerned, that the Rambam says that the reason kviya works by a get is because he assumes that essentially it doesn't speak Yiddish, but he talks about the pinkel yid, that there is inside the Jew who wants to do the right thing. That whenever somebody isn't behaving properly, so that's not the real him. That the real you wants to do the right thing. And what can we do? The Yitzhahara gets in the way. The Yitzhahara stops you from acting like you really want to act. And therefore, we gotta kind of beat the Yitzhahara out of you. So, by doing that, so that allows the real you to emerge, and therefore, once we've gotten rid of that pesky Yitzhahara, so now the desire to give the get actually expresses itself, and that is the rotsani. There's a little bit of synergy here, because this is a topic in Vayera Bal B'Shalach, the whole question of how can power continue to have free will if we believe axiomatically that free will has to exist. So how could it be that here we find that God says repeatedly that he's hardened his heart
and yet we assume humans have free will. How do we reconcile that? So there are various theories. We mentioned this a little bit on Thursday. But one is that maybe sometimes a person is being prevented by external circumstances from controlling his free will. And therefore, he needs a little encouragement to get to the free will. And maybe that's what's going on here, that we assume the real ratzon is to do the right thing, and we have to put it mildly, encourage that real person to come out. So this is the understanding of the Rambam. Not everyone agrees that that's exactly what's going on, but again, this is a very often quoted view. So, hi.
Is the Rambam Scottish? He's not busy pulling that out from like a specific...
So it's a good question. It's not clear. Again, the Gemara has the sentence "Kofen also ad shiyomer rotzani." So that part is from the Gemara. The idea that it's the pitzliyah. There's a lot written on this where there's an attempt to try to figure out where he's getting it from. It sounds like that's essentially his interpretation of that statement. There's a sefer called Elu Kofen Lahotzi. It's a contemporary sefer on Kfiya Beget, as you expect. So it's mostly halachic sefer, but the introduction, he has kind of a little more conceptual analysis of mostly about that Rambam, exactly where he's getting it from, the fact that the Chavos Yor has a tshuva where he questions the whole imagery, because he says that it's not even, let's say you're hitting somebody physically, so it's not even that you've actually gotten rid of the Yetzer, it's that the person is really afraid of the next, it's the next Zetz, you know, that... If, let's say, he hit the person 10 times, and he knew that was it, there's not going to be anything more, so then he probably wouldn't give the get. So the only reason he's going to say, okay, fine, is because he's afraid of the next one. And so Chavos Yor argued that half of the Rambam's picture be right, that the Rambam is saying that he got rid of the Yetzer Hara, the Yetzer Hara is really still there. So the Chavos Yor says it must be a different picture, really, that really thinks that bypass the Rambam. He thinks that really the idea is that we focus on the action. He's doing something, he's writing the get, and he should be writing the get, because why should he be mocking his wife for nothing? Why should he be defying the will of Beis Din? So it makes sense to say all the circumstances are that really this is the desire of a normal person. This guy happens to be in the Shogunate and he's not actually conforming with what the whole logical picture should be. So we don't care that much because the external facts fit, says the Chavos Yor. But we need him also to say the words, Rotzani, to cancel out any premise that there's anything not inconsistency with that. So therefore we force him to say the words, Rotzani. But essentially it's because the details already make it logical. It's interesting also. And this is probably all we'll have time to say, and then we'll have to continue this topic next week. But again, there are other theories as to what's going on here in the Rishonim and elsewhere. So there's an interesting Rashbam, which should be quoted also. I don't know, I'm not sure why this Rashbam doesn't get quoted so often, because it's very interesting. But the Gemara in Bava Basra, which you guys saw this year, you guys saw at the beginning of the year, the Gemara in Bava Basra talks about Tzluhu V'Zav and Zvini Zvini, right? You remember this? We spoke about this in the context of Kiddushin, where we say that we know that a woman can't be forced to get married, but can a man be forced to marry a woman? So we talked about that in the context of that sugya of Tzluhu V'Zav. We say that you can force somebody to sell something. So the Rashbam discusses there how the Gemara makes the comparison of forcing somebody to divorce when he's supposed to, when the decision is that that's the case. So the Rashbam explains why this is, and he says that basically the notion is that he's not getting anything out of this marriage. And he discusses it very explicitly in a way that you don't find in so many other places, right? He basically says, put this on the Marvel Comus, you see this today? Yes. Right, you saw the Rashbam, right? So the Rashbam basically says that he's not getting anything out of the marriage because she hates him, right? So there's no relationship there. So there is no positive interaction. So the only thing that's happening is he's keeping her waiting in the chinam. He's keeping her tied up without any benefit. So therefore, we compel him to end it. Now, it's interesting, he doesn't use this terminology, but it's evocative of a phrase that appears elsewhere in the Gemara in Bava Basra. So the Yomi people will get to this very soon, actually. If you want to hop on to Daf Yomi now, just so you can catch up.
So the Gemara has the phrase, kofin al midas tov, that in momentous context, that we compel people not to act like sodomites, not to act like people from stone. So the Gemara over there makes it clear what that means, that it refers to somebody who doesn't want other people to benefit, even if it doesn't cost them anything. That's this one version of what Midas Tov means. So even though he doesn't use that phrase here, it sounds like essentially that's a comparable situation. I mean, that basically you don't want the wife to benefit by having her freedom, even though the continued marriage is not benefiting the husband. The husband's not getting anything out of the marriage. There's no positive relationship there. So the only reason to stay in it is to hurt her. So that's why we compel it. So it sounds a little bit evocative of kofin al midas tov. Again, I don't know if the Rashbam means to explicitly connect it to, but the idea that a Beis Din will be kofin to not act in this stone-like fashion, it seems a little bit parallel to what he's describing there. And the Tosus has a comment over there also that essentially the Gemara says that tluv v'zavin zvini zvini, but tluv v'yoyiv doesn't work. That basically if we force you to sell something, so at the end of the day it's considered to be a sale. But if we force you to give something as a gift, so then that doesn't work. And we understand why. Because if we force you to sell something, so the assumption, the explicit assumption is that even though you weren't really interested in selling this, but at the end of the day, the guy is paying you for it, so therefore, okay, you decided at the end, all right, I'll take the money and I'm giving up my item. I think we also mentioned earlier in the year how there's also the implication here that really every sale is essentially a little bit coercive, because maybe if you didn't need the money, you would never sell anything, you would hold on to everything you had. So the reason you sell anything is because as much as you'd like to keep it, but you need the money more, so you feel pressured to sell. So once we say that there's such a thing as a valid sale, we're acknowledging that some degree of pressure is acceptable if at the end of the day you get paid for it. So through here, you sell an item and you get paid, even if you wouldn't have chosen to do this, and presumably it's an issur d'oraisa to do this to somebody, because it should be a violation of one of the aseret hadibros, right? Should be a violation of Lo Sachmot, but the sale should be final once that happens. So that's the thing from Tluhu B'Yoyiv, that if you're going to force somebody to give a gift, so then why in the world should that be binding? That's Gzela, right? So if you're forcing somebody to give you something without any compensation, so then there isn't really any reason why that should be considered valid. The only thing that makes the sale valid is the fact that the guy's getting paid. If he's not getting paid, then there isn't anything that we should count for that. So Tosfos asks, so why is getting it all comparable to this? He's not getting paid to give the get, so why is that considered to be comparable to Tlu V'Zavin being forced to sell? We should compare that to somebody who's being forced to give a gift. So Tosfos has two answers which are instructive. One answer is that there is a monetary obligation that he has right now by continuing to stay married. So essentially there is an upside financially for him to end the marriage. So that's why we can compare it more to a sale than to a gift. And the other answer Tosfos has is it's the mitzvah, that if there's an obligation to do it, so then he's fulfilling his obligation, so that makes it more comparable to a gift than to a, sorry, more comparable to a sale than to a gift. Now, parenthetically, you could compare that maybe to a statement that appears in Bava Kamma. The Gemara says that normally there are different obligations. You know, when we learn Samachi in elementary school, and so we know that there is a different level of obligation. If you're watching somebody's property, so you have a higher level of obligation if you're paid, if you're a shomer sacher, than if you are not paid, if you do it for free as a shomer chinam. So the Gemara says in Bava Kamma, what happens if you find a lost object? You're a shomer avedah, so you're obligated to watch an object that you find. So what level of responsibility does the shomer avedah have? We would say that he's like a shomer chinam, because no one's paying him, so we should treat him like a shomer chinam. Or should we say that he's like a shomer sacher for some reason? So the Gemara concludes that he's called a Shomer Sacher. The Gemara has two possible reasons why, even though we don't see any overt payments here, why he should be called a Shomer Sacher. And one of the reasons is Rachman and Meshach, the Torah committed him here. So I think you can understand that two ways. You can understand that either to mean that in Achanami he's not getting paid, but it doesn't matter because the Torah committed him to this higher level of obligation, and therefore he's treated like a Shomer Sacher. Or you could say that it means that the Schar Mitzvah is the Schar, that the fact that the Torah puts him in this relationship, so that counts as if he's getting paid. I think that phrase lends itself to those two interpretations. So I think this Tosfos also gives you those same two interpretations, that you could say that in Hachanami it's not like a sale because there's no payment, but yeah, the mitzvah means that stands in for payment and you are obligated to do it anyway, so you can't say what makes this into a two-sided transaction. Or maybe he refers to the Schar Mitzvah. Okay, you're getting paid that way, you're doing what you're supposed to do, and therefore that's going to be the case.
Someone was speaking to Jay about the Seder about the fact that when we try to compare Gittin and Mecher, we say that like Mecher, you know, you gain the fact that at least you're getting money at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then we said, we're talking amongst ourselves that, you know, and then the Rashbam goes, you know, well, she hates you anyway, you know, you're not getting anything out of it. But like, there's significant disincentive to get the boards, right? You have a ksuba in place, and then you also lose all of her nechasim that you and your maisiyada come from her. So it's not really so question to say that, like.
Yeah, and some do raise that question on the Rashbam. You're right. I mean, it's true. It's one could describe a scenario where, even though in some of the cases we'll see that there isn't a ksuba necessarily, but still it depends on what the circumstances are. But you're right. It's not so obvious that there's no benefit to him other than torture here. And there are those who raise this question in the Rashbam, but I think by itself the Rashbam is interesting because it reflects the perspective that we talk about a lot nowadays, but you don't really find it so much in the other source. But together with the Tosfos, I think you may put those two ideas together, that what you're saying about the financial disadvantage, so Tosfos is kind of addressing that. Right? Tosfos is basically saying that how can we compare this to a sale? There's no financial upside. So Tosfos gives these two answers as to what kind of stands in for the financial upside. So I think if you take the Tosfos with the Rashbam, the Tosfos basically is telling you how to cancel out the fact that it shouldn't be viewed as just giving away something for free. And then plug it back in for the Rashbam. So okay, so it's a wash on the financial side, and then okay, he's not getting anything else out of the marriage. I think that's what you have to do, bring the two together. But in any event, so that's a question, how exactly to understand how this is comparable to a sale. So essentially, the idea that there is kfiya seems to correlate to a couple of possibilities. That either it's something that's independent by itself, and I'll have to explain that a little bit more next week, or that it has to do with kfiya al-hamitzvos. So it has to do with the fact that there's some obligation here, and that obligation therefore creates a basis for Beis Din to compel. So what is the mitzvah? So the mitzvah could be like some sofer, it's in the tshuva mitzvah of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. It could be like we're trying to force into the Rashbam a kofal mitzvah stone, and I'll be the stone. But the simplest understanding is the Gemara that sounds like this also, is that it has to do with the mitzvah l'shmo with the recha chamin. That since there is a tzivoy from chachamin to go through with this divorce, then that's what constitutes the mitzvah that is the basis for the kfiya, and that's what the Rambam refers to when he says that the pintel yid wants to do the right thing. What's the right thing? The right thing is to listen to the chachamim. So that's a very, very crucial detail. And even though there's a whole other model of kfiya that we'll have to mention next week, but what emerges here, and this is certainly what's brought in Shulchan Aruch, is that for kfiya to take place, the kfiya that the Mishnah and other Gemaras talk about, for that to be a valid option, there has to be a sacred bezdin, essentially, and that this has to be carried out by the bezdin. The bezdin is creating this pressure. It can't be that it's a pressure coming from, say, the non-Jewish authorities, which is why we're going to have some major complications when talking about some of the legal remedies that are suggested.
unless the Beis Din is using the non-Jewish authorities as an enforcement method. If the Beis Din commands it, and the Beis Din says, okay, to the non-Jewish muscle, okay, make sure that what we said happens, so then that is theoretically viable. But where the kfiyah is coming from becomes a pretty significant detail, a very crucial detail. So basically, just not to dive in so much detail, but just to recap some of the key points, and then we'll dive into that. We see that normally a get has to be given willingly, but we see already from the Mishnah and the Gemara that there are cases where the get can be compelled, but a couple of details are going to be crucial. That the compulsion has to be justified, and what justifies it, we'll have to expand a little bit more, and has to be carried out in the right way. And if those two details are not paid careful attention to, we could end up having big problems. The get could end up not being valid. And so therefore, there's a lot to fight about in those details in any given situation. That is the kfiyah itself that may be taking place. Is it justified? And even if it's justified, is the pressure being carried out in a halachically acceptable way? That's just a little bit of a preview of what we'll see, and ultimately we'll get to the prenups, whether it's next week or whether it takes another day to get there. But what those questions are going to be crucial. Is the kfiyah justified and how is it being carried out? But what also will come up as a crucial question is whatever remedy we're talking about even considered kfiyah? It could be that some of the remedies we may discuss may not necessarily rise to the level of kfiyah, and therefore those questions will be less important. So this is all a part of the puzzle. Is a given action that we're thinking of doing, is it called kfiyah in the first place? If it is called kfiyah, then is the kfiyah justified? Maybe it is. And if it is justified, so then is this being carried out in a way that is consistent with what the halacha requires? All of those are important questions, which we'll have to try to look into a little bit more. Who wants to dive first? Okay, no.